move on to the 60s this week, and I have no qualifications whatever for talking about that period in terms of expertise in the literature or the music. Other colleagues have much more expertise in an academic sense, if you like. My only claim to be able to talk about the time is that I actually remember it. And I guess you'll be, you and the next few 2 or 3 years of students will be the last generation of students who will be taught by people who lived through and remember not only the 60s, but the 50s, in fact. And the best way I can think of, although it's a seemingly frivolous way, of bringing home the gap between you and me in this respect, is to say that in the, I guess, late autumn of 1962, early winter, I went into what used to be called a barber's in Bristol, in the centre of Bristol, where I was at school, a men's hairdresser's. It was, by my standards and the standards of the time, a sort of upmarket men's hairdresser in that it had pictures outside of film stars, their hair greased back to indicate the kind of styles they could approximate to. And the in those days, I had quite long hair, not as long as it was to become later, but long enough to get me into trouble at school. I wasn't going to the barber's because I was in trouble at school. I had a particular aim in mind, and when the barber asked me what that was, I said, well, have you heard of a group called the Beatles? And he said, no, sir. That is the difference between you and me, that I come from a time when it was possible not to have heard of the Beatles because they had only just begun to exist in the autumn of 1962 when Love Me Do came out, I think early October. Late October was the time of the Cuban missile crisis. A quite different order of experience altogether. Essentially, what happened was that the Soviet Union sent a cargo of nuclear missiles on its way to Cuba and threatened to install them there within very easy striking distance of the USA. And that was under Khrushchev. And Kennedy, who was the American president, threatened a preemptive strike against the Soviet Union. And for 10 weeks, 10 days, 12 days, we really thought the world was very likely to come to an end. Indeed, it was quite likely to come to an end. And I remember on the Friday of that second week, walking at lunchtime again on the Downs in Bristol and seeing a whole lot of jet planes absolutely tearing across, very low across the sky. I think pretty well every fighting plane in the UK, known by Christopher Hitchens soon afterwards as USS Aircraft Carrier Great Britain, because of the number of American bases we had and our strategically very dangerous position we were in from both points of view, if you see what I mean, of launching an attack and also receiving one. Every single plane of any capability was off the ground at that time as long as it could be to avoid the possibility that it could be hit on the ground. And it just seeing them tearing across at that moment was kind of 16 and a half, was really frightening. And so frightening that the person I was with, a friend, and I decided we weren't going to go back to school, but we'll go to the pub instead. Those are my not very important memories of that time, but they're there to sort of authenticate some of what I'm going to say. And I now want to put you in the position of a little thought experiment. Imagine, and this bit is not going to be very hard to do, that you are in a country which is fighting an unpopular and probably unwinnable war. Imagine beyond that that it's going so badly that your government has decided to introduce conscription. That's to say, everybody above the age of 18, let's suppose it's both genders now, will be called up for military service automatically, and as a result of that, will be liable to be sent to the front line and liable to be killed. You are against this war, and so you decide to have a demonstration here at Warwick against it. It may also be in your mind, I don't want to impugn your motives, but it may also be in your mind that you don't want to go and get killed. Anyway, you have a demonstration, and the authorities call out a branch of something between the police and the army. They're quite heavily armed. They're not very experienced. They're your sort of age, some of them. They're probably a bit scared because although they have weapons, you outnumber them considerably. They also may agree with the war that's going on that you disagree with. They, after all, they've already, in a sense, been called up. They may also be a little bit jealous of your situation as students. And the importance of the rise in the student population in this period is one that I'm going to say something about in a moment. Anyway, somebody trigger-happy loses off around, and other people hearing that wonder if they've come under fire, shall we say. Nobody quite knows how it happens. 63 rounds of ammunition are fired. 11 of you fall to the ground injured. Four of you will die. Okay, four of you will die on your university campus as a result of protesting against this war. That was the situation on a campus not that unlike Warwick. In the northeast USA, Kent State campus, 40 years ago this May, in 1970, at the end of our period, a real situation and real casualties. Now, part of the rationale of this module, obviously, is to try to set ideas of modernity in a historical context. As I explained and argued right at the beginning, newness is a relative term. But another part is to show that the past can continue to speak to the present. We began with writers who were interested in responding to the world innovatively, for the most part in terms of their style, perhaps less so, as Orwell argued, in terms of their engagement with what was actually happening in the world. They were Yeats, for example, and Eliot, and Pound, to some extent Virginia Woolf, though she was a feminist. They had strong conservative tendencies in their political outlook. Then we moved on to a time of different types of engagement, represented by Orwell and again by Primo Levi, particularly under wartime conditions. And now we're in a period, 1950s and particularly the 60s, in which, as at the beginning of the century, modernity of style was again considered important, though, as before, not by everybody. But where that innovation occurred, it was as likely as not to be tied to some concern with the outside world, with the world as a world, not just as a nation, as a group of nation states, and with the responsibilities of the writer to a radical kind of engagement with how it's run. And this applied, of course, in the music and the visual arts as well as in writing. It's interesting that 40 and 50 years on, there seems to be a quite strong tide of interest in that period among people like you. What I don't detect is the same kind of sense that the world can be changed, that by active involvement, by protests, by meeting together politically, you can make things hugely different and better. I may be wrong about that. I may be doing you an injustice. Or I may be doing you a justice, because it may be that you say to yourselves, well, people tried that in the 1960s, and it doesn't look as if things are that much different. Why should I be killed on the Warwick campus for a cause that is not likely to succeed? At any rate, empirically, no one has as yet occupied University House in protest against the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan. Now, the 1960s, of course, began in the 1950s, and the 1950s began in the Second World War and so on back. I just want to give you a sort of extremely broad brush sketch of a few considerations in the immediate post-war period, the period, that's to say, in which the people who were to be the 1960s generation were born or were very young and beginning to grow up. The first thing is that during the Second World War, people fighting on the Allied side were told that things were going to be better afterwards. They wanted a better life, and they were told they were going to get one. That was something which was had to be delivered on by government after the war ended. The second thing, of course, is that there, when people came back from the war and when peace had been established, there was a rapid increase in the birth rate. A whole lot of people who'd held off from having children voluntarily or compulsorily because they were separated by the war went ahead. And the third thing that there is that there was, in the West, a massive increase in prosperity, which reached right down to the ordinary domestic level, to every level. Nobody in the West was unaffected by it. It came about partly as a result of the peace and of the loosening up of economic forces that had previously been, for some time, dedicated to militarization. It came about partly through technological advances, which paradoxically had been brought about by militarization. It came about also through the massive loosening of imperial boundaries and imperial powers, and I'll come on to that in a moment. But in a nutshell, the strong ties held, the strong controls held by particularly the British Empire over countries in its dominion were loosened, and that enabled America to move in. Against all that, there was, of course, what we think of as the Cold War, but which wasn't, as the Cuban Missile Crisis suggests, always quite so cold. And to understand that, you have to know that at the end of the Second World War, many people thought the Third World War would almost immediately start. That was a very widespread belief. If you read, for example, J.G. Ballard's Empire of the Sun, when he was in the camp in Shanghai, as a boy, the character based on J.G. Ballard believes that this is almost immediately going to happen. And if you think about it in terms of Europe, what you have to imagine quite straightforwardly is that two massive and ferociously, by now, well-armed bodies of forces were advancing towards each other. The Soviet forces were sweeping westwards, and they'd shown that they could move fast and do a lot of damage. The Americans and the British and the Free French, likewise, were moving eastwards. And we know historically that they were going to stop, and that Germany would be divided, and that then that there would be the uneasy peace that became the Cold War. But from either side, what it looked like was these people, these armies, were tearing across towards you. And on both sides, high commanders and people in political power were doing all they could to prepare for the possibility that the Soviet Union would advance at least as far as the English-French Channel, and that on the other side, that the Americans particularly would carry on at least to the very borders of the old Soviet Union. So it was a time of very great alarm and uncertainty, and at the same time of course, a wholly new kind of terror. And that was introduced by what people knew almost immediately had happened in Hiroshima. And if you think about it, this was the first time in human history. I mean, people had always thought the world would come to an end. They thought it would come to an end just of itself, or through divine intervention, zap, because people had behaved badly, or through a natural disaster, a collision of planets. And by now, scientists knew that the last of those could happen perfectly well. But this was the first time in the history of the world where you could confidently say that it would be possible for human beings to obliterate themselves as a race, and that it could happen by design, or it could happen completely by accident, so that the continuation of hostilities between the capitalist West and the communist East was a time of fear which hung over this new prosperity and this new hope of the late 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. It's often said that human beings can't bear too much reality. Eliot has a quotation to that effect. What's extraordinary in a way is how much reality humankind can bear, how much people can know about the fragility of their position, and at the same time go ahead and have a great time. And I think that to some extent, again, to put this in at a pretty frivolous level, that the kind of great reception that the Beatles had in 1962 and 63 and thereafter, as well as other groups, there was an element of relief after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that early period in the 60s, while there was a great deal of political commitment and engagement, there was also a feeling of sheer hedonism. And I'll try to come on to that too in the very little time that I've got to sort of broad brush these things. Now, all this played out in different ways in different parts of the world. In the USA, as you know, there was a very, very powerful anti-communist movement which led to censorship of certain kinds of writer and indeed threats against the freedom of certain kinds of writer. This was whipped up to a frenzy by Senator McCarthy in a way that sort of eerily anticipated the war against terror or what George Bush the Second even called the crusade against terror all those decades later. On the other hand, equally in the USA, this was a time of struggle for civil rights. Apartheid was going strong in the USA. You know all about that. And you know, let's not be complacent about this in terms of Western Europe or the UK, which had its own problems and which still, in relation to the rest of the world, can be seen as operating economically a kind of apartheid. We can't pretend that our conditions sitting here in this room are the same as those in Darfur or Liberia or Chile. And so we have to think to some extent whether this is, in a sense, something we have to engage with and have a responsibility to. In continental Europe, however, the issue of the war against communism was not strong. On the contrary, Western European countries had a great deal of sympathy with communism, not least because it had been the main source of resistance to fascism and Nazism. And the people who came to power after those forces were conquered, though of course not in Spain, where the Second World War was in effect won by the far right, the people who had been who came to power were people who had fought against those things. So communism had a sympathetic hearing in Germany, in France, in Italy. And characteristically, Britain was sort of halfway between the two in its sort of mid-Atlantic stance with its common language with the USA and its inherited and inherent suspicion of people who speak foreign languages. Again, I may return to that. Another point about, there was also a difference between Britain and the other countries in Western Europe that I mentioned, and that was that it didn't have to feel bad about the Second World War. In fact, it rather overdid feeling good about the Second World War. It was a kind of play, it was a playground chant when I was a small child, that we won the war in 1944, and we would just recite that. And we really believed that, in some sense, that we had, certainly in the sense of our team, Team UK, had won the war in 1944. An awful lot of what went wrong subsequently between Britain and Western Europe in the founding of what was then called the Common Market and EU goes back to that belief. The Battle of Britain mentality, making it extremely hard for Britain not only to behave as a true neighbor to its immediate geographical neighbors, but also, and this is at least as important, to adjust its expectations to its real place in the new world, particularly as a former imperial power. The writing had been on the wall economically from the 19th century for anybody to read. And if you read an excellent book by Paul Kennedy called The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, you'll see there that he argues that war, that the First and the Second, particularly the Second World War, didn't so much create a state of affairs as enact and dramatize and force to attention what was already the underlying state of affairs in terms of who was powerful and who wasn't. The Second World War impoverished the UK, and immediately afterwards, partly as a result, of course also as a result of good wishes and enlightenment on the part of some people, but essentially as a matter of realpolitik, it shed itself of its colonies, or if you like to put it that way, allowed independence to those countries. However, in all this, there was this great rise in prosperity, rise in the birth rate, big expansion in healthcare provision and education, including a steady rise in the percentage of children that stayed at school after 16 and in the percentage of people who went to university. Here's a statistic that may not seem very startling to you because we're so much in a post-agricultural world, or we think we are. In 1960, the USA became, for the first time in the history of the world, it became the first country in the history of the world in which students outnumbered farm workers. 1960 became the first country in which students outnumbered farm workers. By the end of the 1960s in the USA, there were three times as many students as farm workers. So here is this newly influential, important, privileged section of the population, and similar statistics are available for Western Europe and the UK, people who were suddenly subsidized by the state, as well as by their parents, to be intellectuals for 3 years or so, to live the life of an artist, of a bohemian. It's sort of the democratization of bohemianism, if you like. And it had its effects in the arts and in politics. Now, here's just one example. It goes right back to 1944, the end of the war in Europe. A bunch of friends began to form on the fringe of Columbia University, which is in New York City, in the sort of fairly high up in the on the edge of Harlem. Harlem, of course, was a great center of political and cultural and artistic excitement. And on the fringe of Columbia, on the fringe of Harlem, a bunch of people got together and became friends and started to think how they could work together and alone. And they included Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, who I know you've been hearing a lot about on Modes of Reading if you're doing that module, and William Burroughs. And they were the nucleus of the Beat Generation. And I'll say a little bit more about Kerouac in a moment. At roughly the same moment, a gay American black writer who lived in Harlem moved to Paris, was James Baldwin. And in the immediate post-war period, there was an after-echo of high modernism, in that there was once again a sort of an exchange between the English-speaking countries and what was happening in Europe, and particularly in Paris. He, Baldwin, lived there while he was writing two of his best books, Go Tell It on the Mountain and Giovanni's Room. They're both 1950s books. I've got a list on the back of the on the handout somewhere, which I hope will enable you to look things up if you don't hear them when I say them. Another US writer who lived in Europe in those days, I could list very many, was Terry Southern, who is best known now as the author of the script for Dr. Strangelove, fantasy about nuclear war. And although he was written out of the credits, also Dr. Strangelove, also Easy Rider, which he was very much involved in. Terry Southern was in Europe on the GI Bill. Anybody who had served in the US Army was guaranteed a sum of money that would enable them to have a university education, and they could use that money in Europe if they chose to. They didn't have to use it in the USA. So that you can see the Beat Movement as almost directly coming out of the Second World War in this strange economic and educational sense. Terry Southern's novel Candy, 1958, was first published in Paris in order to evade the obscenity laws in the USA. And another part of the complex tapestry that I'm trying to just give you some glimpses of is a very important part, is the continuation of censorship and the war against censorship, which was taking place in many different countries. In Great Britain, censorship continued until 1961, as far as books were concerned. Lady Chatterley's Lover, D.H. Lawrence's novel, was only available in expurgated form until Penguin Books decided to publish it as a complete text and were duly prosecuted and won the prosecution. In the theatre, censorship continued for some time longer. The Royal Court Theatre in London turned itself into a members-only club in order to be able to show plays that otherwise would not have passed the censorship. And Edward Bond's Saved was, again, the locus classicus of a battle over whether that was a proper use of club legislation in 1965. Just to link once again, and I'm sorry about dotting around here, but to link once again Baldwin and Southern in Europe in the 1950s, early 60s, and the period of high modernism, there are various links, of whom Samuel Beckett, whom you've been thinking a little bit about, is one. Beckett, as you know, had been James Joyce's secretary. He lived in Paris. He turned himself into a French writer. Most of his work was published, first of all, in the French language and performed, first of all, in the French language. He fought for the French resistance and stayed on in Paris after he became famous with En Attendant Godot, Waiting for Godot. And the intellectual atmosphere of Paris in that period was very influential in Anglophone countries. So there was a time lag quite often between the publication of books in France and in translation. I mean, a longer time lag than can be accounted for by translation. I'm thinking particularly, not only of Beckett, of course, but of Camus and Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. Camus was one of the founders of what is now thought of as absurdism. Sartre, one of the proponents of what came to be called existentialism. The two of them fell out over whether there could be any compatibility or obligation in political and social terms arising out of the sense that the world meant nothing, that there was nothing outside our everyday life, no transcendental being, God had absented himself or didn't exist at all. Did that leave you in a situation of total anarchic moral freedom, the situation of absurdism, or did it bring a different kind of obligation? Sartre's view was that if you lived in a state of nothingness, néant, of despair at the belief that there were no moral absolutes, no transcendental beliefs, you became a kind of vegetable. And the only way you could rescue yourself from that condition was to think about other people and how you could help them. And that in that process, you gave meaning to your own life. And he was, of course, closely linked in relationship terms as well as ideological ones to Simone de Beauvoir, whose own version of that was what was called in that time women's liberation. She was the first significant figure of the feminist movement in the post-war period with her book Le Deuxième Sexe, The Second Sex. And feminism as a political movement is another aspect of this period that you need to bear in mind in your reading. It took another step forward at the end of the period covered by this module, 1970, when a book called The Female Eunuch was written on this campus by a junior member of the English department called Germaine Greer. That book was published in 1970. The impact of Camus and Sartre in Britain, as well as in the USA, was quite profound, and particularly through a novelist called Iris Murdoch, who had translated Sartre. She started out as a philosopher and published a book on Sartre. And It's important to remember, because she was essentially, or became increasingly, a rather conservative writer, that these movements happened in very different ways and at different paces. Then, as now, it was not the case that people were absolutely consistent in their beliefs, or that every member of what seemed from outside to be a group all thought the same thing about everything. Iris Murdoch was often linked with two writers in England who became known as the founders of something called the movement. The poet Philip Larkin, who started out thinking he was a novelist, and the novelist Kingsley Amis, who started out thinking he was a poet. They had in common a keen interest and keen expert knowledge of jazz. Larkin in particular wrote a lot about jazz. Jazz, one of the key movements of artistic modernism. And yet, in terms of their cultural attitudes and their attitudes to writing, they were profoundly conservative, anti-modernist, and anti-international. They didn't like much that was American. They didn't like anything that was foreign in terms of language. Philip Larkin famously said he wouldn't mind going abroad if he could come back the same day, which was an idea that was rather less realistic when he said it in the 1960s than it is today. So the point I'm trying to make is that despite the generalizations I'm making and will go on making, one has always to think about the countercurrents that are going on. And also of the ways in which odd bridges can be made. As soon as you start to look at the work itself, you suddenly realize that whatever the attitudes of these writers, whatever the formation of these writers, something of what they're seeing is the same. I've given you a poem by Philip Larkin called Mr. Bleeny. And I just want you to think about that in relation to Beckett's work, which you've been thinking about. Mr. Bleeny, who could be a Beckett character, sitting in his bedsit, having a dreary life and wondering whether it has any meaning at all. And those last stanzas, if he stood... And you've got to watch the sort of syntax of that, because the if is left hanging for eight lines. If he stood and watched the frigid wind tousling the clouds, lay on the fusty bed telling himself that this was home, and grinned and shivered without shaking off the dread that how we live measures our nature, and at his age having no more to show than one hired box should make him pretty sure he warranted no better... I don't know. You see how he's conjuring up a picture of somebody who is afraid that this wretched life he has is what he deserves. How we live measures our nature. But at the same time, the poem is ending with its own kind of shrug. I don't know. If he thought that, well, who can tell? Now, all the writers, I think, that I've mentioned so far had lived through the Second World War. And some of them had taken an active part in it. Jack Kerouac served in the American Merchant Navy. Camus and Beckett were in the French Resistance, as also was Sartre, who was caught, captured by the Germans and imprisoned for some time. Kingsley Amis was in the British Army. So that, and that experience brought many of them face to face with sectors of the population that they would not otherwise have encountered. And so in a different way from the conscious experimentalism of Orwell and Henry Green that we talked about earlier, affected their style and their attitudes, sometimes temporarily, sometimes permanently. Among the dominant influences, culturally speaking, was of course Kerouac himself. And On the Road, published in 1957, you can think about it as a reaction against wartime discipline, against wartime constrictions, but at the same time for a self-uniting with absolutely anybody you meet, the kind of self-uniting that was the only way in which you could survive in an army or a navy, if you couldn't make yourself get along with the people you were sharing quarters with, you'd pretty much had it. On the Road was one of the leading elements in a vogue for narratives of aimless hedonistic vagrancy and anti-authoritarianism. Easy Rider, the movie, is another example. And meaningless journeys became a handy metaphor for the meaninglessness of life itself. Aimless journeys, meaningless journeys, journeys that ended in crashes, as Camus' life did, Road Crash, the movie star James Dean earlier, crashes which became the focus of a kind of art and literature movement with J.G. Ballard, with his early 70s novel, Crash, which was made into a movie. But what you have to look for in these texts of despair and pointlessness is also incandescent touches of romanticism and glee and amateur poetry. As in the beginning of Kerouac's book, which you've got on the handout there. I first met Dean. Of course, there's a sort of endless journey in the text itself of On the Road. Kerouac typed it on a continuous strip of paper. I first met Dean not long after my wife and I split, and I just got over a serious illness that I won't bother to talk about, except that it had something to do with the miserably weary split up and my feeling that everything was doomed. With the coming of Dean Moriarty began the part of my life you could call, sorry, I've got a bad Xerox here, which makes me suspect that perhaps you have too. I'm going to try and get a better one. Somewhere here. Perhaps I can't. The part of my life you could call my life on the road. And on it goes to this passage about dancing down the street like Dingle Dodies after the Star Line. And I shambled after, as I've been shambling all my life, after people who interest me, because the only people for me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to something, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones who never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like fabulous yellow Roman candles exploding like spiders across the stars, and all of that. So there's an antithesis going on between a sense of meaningless and a sense of exuberant life and relish of its every moment, which is comparable to the antithesis between people's ability to see that in all sorts of ways that circumstances were intolerable and terrifying, and on the other hand, their ability to close their minds to that and have a good time. Obviously, On the Road spoke, among other things, to rock musicians whose life was a road life. And culturally, it's important to register how much came out of art schools, rock groups, but also writers. Art schools weren't attached to universities in those days. They were entirely practical. They gave opportunities for experiment that wasn't constrained by the requirements of analysis and intellectual explanation. And they were also another place of considerable democratization. John Lennon spoke about having met somebody at art school who had been at a public school, Westminster, and Lennon had been reading On the Road, and this boy at Westminster had been reading On the Road, and suddenly they both felt that, you know, that they had a common language. The social divisions and the educational divisions between them didn't matter. And it's not a big jump from all that to the opening of Joni Mitchell's song Woodstock, which I was hoping to play you, but the machine isn't working. I came upon a child of God. He was walking down the road, walking along the road, and I asked him where he was going, and this he told me. I'm going to join in a rock and roll band. I'm going to camp out on the land and try to get my soul free. Then I can walk beside you. I've come here to lose the smog. If you listen to her singing it, or if you can remember her voice singing it, it has that kind of brittle, naive stupidity, if you like, of hippiness at its most self-caricaturing. But it's a very touching evocation of the aspiration of people and the hope of people at that time, that things could be easy, that relationships could be natural, that bad things needn't happen. But of course there were other writers, including songwriters, and Bob Dylan was one, who saw that things were more complicated than that and gave voice to visceral and violent images that were all too easy to access. Dylan later, including in some bits in that Scorsese documentary, claimed that he wasn't at all political, that his work had been appropriated for political ends. Well, of course, that can happen, that there's something like being a medium in a certain kind of art. It can voice what's going on in a culture without the conscious ambition of the artist to do so. But I think that that retrospective view of Dylan's is also perhaps a self-falsification, a regret, perhaps, at the naivety, as he came to see it, of what he seemed to be saying to his generation and the younger generation in the times there are changing, or chimes of freedom. Anger was one of the key moods of the time. Innocence, optimism, naive belief in changing the world, but also anger. This was what you find, is what you find in James Baldwin's books about racial and sexual prejudice. It's what you find in new work by post-colonial writers such as Nadine Gordimer or Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, who we'll come on to in a couple of weeks' time. But there was also, and also, a sense of hilarious comic frustration that this anger could not actually change how things operated. And that found its most complex and most simultaneously most popular expression in literary terms in Catch-22 by Joseph Heller. You can all fill in the sort of angry bit probably for yourselves in terms of British culture, John Wayne, John Osborne, and I'm not going to hold us up by getting stuck in that particularly provincial movement, though it was expressive and powerful at the time. But I do want to say something briefly about the power of students and of student anger in all this. Remember, again, it's the time of the civil rights movement, of anti-nuclear and anti-war demonstrations. And some of what was coming into focus was expressed in something called the Port Huron Statement, which I've given you a quote from, put out in 1962 by an American student organization called Students for a Democratic Society. And the Port Huron Statement may ring some bells with you today. It begins, "We are people of this generation, bred in at least modest comfort, housed now in universities, looking uncomfortably to the world we inherit. Loneliness, estrangement, isolation describe the vast distance between man and man today. These dominant tendencies cannot be overcome by better personnel management, nor by improved gadgets, but only when a love of man overcomes the idolatrous worship of things by man." That statement was inflected by the existentialism of Sartre that I described earlier. The problem with it, of course, in terms of its impact, as also the problem with existentialism and absurdism, is that not everybody will come up with meanings that are as constructive and optimistic as that. You could look at the world around you and equally well think that the most reasonable expression of it in artistic terms was something pretty close to the Dadaism of the earlier 20th century. There was a lot of Dadaism around, neo-Dadaism, in this period. I need to be careful about this because somebody lecturing on Dadaism in the 1960s prompted a Dadaist reaction when all the students threw potato salad at him. Fortunately, you didn't know I was going to mention this, so you haven't come armed with potato salad. But there were these completely bananas gestures that were very funny and very enjoyable as long as you were on the inside of them. Ken Kesey's gang of lunatics called the Merry Pranksters, for example, who raced around the USA in a Dayglow bus painted with the word further, with a loud hi-fi on it, driven by Neil Cassady, on whom On the Road is based, taking all the drugs they could find and pressing them on bewildered citizenry wherever they stopped, jumping out of the bus and giving them a heap of drugs of various kinds. Tom Wolfe, a vivid factual journalist of the time and literature of fact, is another important dimension of this period, described the movement by saying you're on the bus or you're off it. But of course, if you weren't on the bus, you were liable to think that some of the people who were on it were, to use a later idiom, off their trolley. So that the 1960s, and this is essentially what I'm coming to, dramatized a problem which lies at the heart of any avant-garde. How do you, any bohemianism, any utopian art movement, how do you reconcile the individualism, the anarchy, the appetite for a completely selfish gratification on which very much great art depends, with a social and moral purpose? In the end, art's relation to politics is indirect at best, and many key figures of the 1950s and the 60s, as of any time, took a different position. I'm not going to go into the conservative arts of the time. I've been generalizing far too much anyway, and I hope you'll have in your seminars the opportunity to focus down on individual texts. But I could give you a long list of writers who, even if, as Nick so clearly demonstrated with Elizabeth Bishop, can be shown to be expressing major cultural and political themes of the time and preoccupations of the time, could be taken then and as now as essentially apolitical. Even more to the point, one of the very strong movements of the period came from Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, from writers who were forcefully engaged against communism, against Stalinism, whose disposition was individualist, conservative, arguably materialist. And so what you have is this dilemma, global dilemma, if you like, sort of comparable in artistic terms to the near collision of the Soviet and the American armies in 1944, of everybody going wild with enthusiasm for freedom, not everybody, going wild with enthusiasm for freedom in the West, and people in the East actually being locked up in concentration camps for their individualist views, and then coming to the West, as Solzhenitsyn did, and becoming identified with strongly conservative ideas. I don't think any of that is going to help you at all, the more I think about it. But if you want a little bit of focus, have a look at the bit in Catch-22, which I hope I've given you on the handout. I'll let you take it away to read it, where very early on in the novel, Heller is expressing the he's making a joke about T.S. Eliot. Usserian is censoring letters and calling people up mischievously on the phone, and he's all the time teasing his superior officers, and one of the ways he does it is by calling somebody up, and when the officer says, "Who is that?" he says, "T.S. Eliot." And the paranoid person on the other end of the phone is besieged by these phone calls from people he's never heard of. He puts the phone on and says, "Has anybody heard of T.S. Eliot?" And there's this great sort of anxiety that there's this person, T.S. Eliot, who's pursuing him. Of course, the point behind it is, it's very, very funny. It's partly to do with intellectual superiority on Usserian's part. It's partly to do with anarchy in a completely authoritarian situation. But it's also to do with the fact that, a great artist acknowledged throughout the English-speaking world and elsewhere can come and go, and yet you can still find yourself in the middle of the Second World War, and not only has nothing that artist said or did made the slightest difference to the world, but a significant number of people around you never heard of him. A bleak message for an in many ways bleak period. Thank you very much.